My name is Katie Johnson, and on August 12th of the year 1990, and remember that year because it will be significant again later, I was invited by Father Roy Bourgeois, who was a visiting Mary Knoller at St. Joan of Arc, to join him on the altar, and I participated in offering the Mass. Before I continue that story, take a deep breath with me. This is very daunting. I have never told this story publicly. Thank you. A frequently asked question, the few times that this comes up from time to time, is people will say to me, did you plan this event with Roy? Or was this something that just kind of happened? If you ask the question that way, I guess I could say it just kind of happened. I just kind of happened to be in the right place at the right time. And there isn't a lot to say about that. But if you rephrase the question to say, was this a random event? The answer to that is a lot longer and I think a lot more interesting. In April of 1979, I had a dream. I had gone to bed Palm Sunday night, same as any other night, woke up the next morning shaking. The memory I have of the dream was very brief, and what seemed to be pretty transparent, what I couldn't really understand was my incredible reaction to the dream. In the dream, I was walking a tightrope, and I was a long ways off the ground. The rope that I was on was not the only rope that was stretched. There was three or four ropes. I was on the highest rope, and on the rope, maybe two or three ropes below me, I looked down because I was in the middle of the rope, and I was terrified. And on this rope was a priest named Bill. And at this time, I'm still not certain who Bill was. There's a couple of candidates here. I looked down and saw this priest, and I stopped shaking. That's all I remember about the dream. But it was a dream that has never left me. It's a dream that has shaped my life since that day. This was back in 1979. I've asked myself a million times, what was the significance of that dream? Katie Johnson on a tightrope is an oxymoron if there ever was one. I was hardly a risk taker. I was the child in school who rarely raised her hand. Not that I didn't know some of the answers to the questions that were being asked, but I had learned early as a female, it wasn't too smart to be too smart in school. I was very pleased to be always seated in the back of the room because when your last name starts with J in the Catholic schools with these long rows and 40 to 45 kids in the class, I was in the back of the room and I could hide and I didn't raise my hand. So on myself being on a tightrope was a real puzzle to me. After that dream, I didn't eat or sleep for 3 days and three nights. I felt like I was a walking zombie. I picked up the phone book and I thumbed through counselors. I needed somebody to help me get my hands on that dream. Later on, I talked to a friend a couple of days later and explained the situation to her. At the time, she was a seminarian at United Theological, and I live in New Brighton, so this was close connection here. And she said to me, you know, there's a woman that keeps coming to the seminary, and you might like to talk with her. Have you ever heard of Olive Ozark Campbell? Well, the name meant nothing to me. A women's ordination was not my issue, and when Olive had been ordained to the Episcopal priesthood, I'm sure I slept right through it. But that was a tip that saved my life. One phone call and a week later, I was seated in Olive Ozark Campbell's study and began a journey that is still with me today, and I consider Olive to be a good friend. She identified herself as a spiritual midwife, and indeed, that is what she did for me. In the days and months and years, literally years that followed that dream, I found that I was not living in the same space anymore. I struggled a long time to find the language to explain what had happened to me. because the power of that dream was far beyond language. It was a very lonely feeling. Allah helped me to read some of the other dreams that were coming through. I would try to explain my situation to women friends. I knew I wasn't going to find a man that could understand it. I had a terrible time finding women who could understand it. The only language I could use to describe my experience was, of course, the language of metaphor. And it was metaphor that was very, very powerful to me, but metaphor that was not terribly significant to the people that I talked to. So I spent 11 years wandering, lost, lonely, no map. Allah coached me through the first 4 years of that time, and then she moved to Oregon, so I was pretty much on my own at that time. The loneliness was caused by several things. First of all, I mentioned the language. There was no language I could use to describe my experience. The metaphor could point to it, but that's all it could do. The second thing was the friends that were sympathetic but simply didn't get what I was saying. The third thing was fear. I was loaded with fear, and I was very unsure of myself. I had a hard enough time accepting the experience myself and believing I wasn't going crazy, so it was very hard for me to open up to somebody else and to see if they could help confirm my experience. And finally, the logic that I had been raised with did not lead me out. I was in a very dark and a very quiet space and had to rely almost exclusively on my intuition, which at that point wasn't functioning too well. It's functioning pretty strongly right now. That was the lantern that helped to lead me out. During this time, my health took a real beating. Before this time, I probably would go to the doctor once every 2 years with a sore throat or something very insignificant. During the past 15 years, I've had a couple of surgeries that I think have a very strong connection to what all of these spiritual issues were about. This was very much of an embodied experience for me. There was not too much that was esoteric about it. During one particularly poignant time, when my health issues were really getting to me, I called Allah out in Oregon and told her what was going on. And she said, "Katie, you are describing a spiritual pregnancy." And I was really blown away. I lived with that for a long time. I was too close to the issue to be able to call it that myself. But the longer I lived with my issues, the more I realized that is exactly what was happening. In the summer of 1990, I hit a particularly intense squall. This whole time since 1979 was pretty much of a storm for me. I hit a very intense squall, and again at the time was very confused by it. It took me years, literally years, to put words on what was happening. I would wake up in the morning, one of three different things would be going on, and it was a repetition over and over and over for 2 months. Incidentally, this squall ended abruptly after I spent time on the altar with Roy Bourgeois. The first thing was that I would wake up in the morning with incredible fear. I would just be curled up in bed in the fetal position. And during those days, I found out that sometimes the greatest act of faith you can make is just getting out of bed in the morning. And I would go for 2, 3, 4, 5 days that way. Once my feet hit the ground, I was okay. But to get from the bed to the ground was an enormous act of faith. I would go for maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 days with nothing happening. So I would have a period of very high agitated energy, followed by a period of relaxation and calm. All of this is relative, I remember. The second thing that would happen after this calm time was a period of 3, 4, 5 days where I would wake up with incredible feelings of loneliness and rejection. And that would happen 3, 4, 5 days. And then that would be followed again by a lull in that time. And the third thing was the part that blew me the most and left me the most confused. I would wake up in the morning with the words, "It's time, I'm ready," going through my head again and again and again. It took me years to play with body movements. It was movement. And I realized that those were undulations. And I realized years later that my soul had gone into labor. On August 12th, I got to church. Normally, I go to the 11 o'clock Mass. And that particular day, I went to the 9 o'clock Mass. A friend had called me earlier in the week. She was supposed to be a part of the host group. The host group at Joan of Arc passes out bulletins, helps to distribute communion. So there are people from the congregation who help out at the services. She called. She and her husband were supposed to be a part of the host group that following weekend at the 9 o'clock Mass. And I said, well, Marianne, you know I don't usually go to the 9 o'clock Mass, but sure, I'll do that. There's a couple of places where you can hand out bulletins, where you can be a member of the host group. I got to church, and I knew which door I wanted to stand in, because it was the door that all my friends went in, and this was a good chance to meet with people. I got to church, and two people were already standing at that door, and so I was directed to go to the door by the sacristy, and I thought, well, that's okay. I can hand out bulletins and smile and greet people there, too. That's where I was standing when Rosie Rogers came out of the sacristy and said, Katie, you're just the person. She knew my history. Father Royce was reading over the readings this morning, and he said he can't do this by himself. Would you like to join him? And that was the first time in 11 years that the question that I had asked, what was this dream all about, ever got answered. For 11 years, that question was greeted with silence. That morning, instantly, at the time of that question, I heard this little voice inside of me saying, this is what this was all about. And I knew instantly, and I just started to shake inside. When I was at the altar, I was very calm. This was the easiest yes I had ever given. I think in that 11 years' time, internally, I had probably played with every imaginable answer to that. That time, it was easy to say yes. I was very calm, and I was not fearful. All my fear had been spent and burned off over the previous 11 years. The experience left me flooded with energy. This was a very, very embodied experience. I could feel energy just exploding out from the center of me. And my body quivered for 3 straight days after this event. The way I describe what happened inside of me, it's the best metaphor I can come up with, is that during that 11-year time, I had somehow built a dam inside of me and stored all of this energy behind that dam. And when I was on the altar with Roy Bourgeois, the dam broke and the energy spilled. And my body was more alive at that time than quite possibly it has ever been in my entire life. The other physical thing about this was that all of my circuits were blown. I had great difficulty talking about what had happened, partly because of the enormity of it, but partly because my wiring was gone. I had friends say to me, how come when we read about this in the newspaper, why isn't your name there? Well, there was a lot of reasons why my name wasn't there. But one of them was because I would have only embarrassed myself talking to the press, because I could not string more than a couple of obvious, inane sentences together about what that experience meant for me. I simply could not capture the words to describe it. It took me 6 weeks to find my voice again after that experience. Ironically, during this time, the 11 years before this experience, this was a time of high creativity for me. What little energy I had moving out was very creative energy. I remember during the very hardest times, I would say that 95% of my energy was preoccupied with internal issues, and 5% was going outside to lead me. Not at all unlike grief, and grief was certainly part of what I was dealing with. But in a grieving situation, so much of your energy is preoccupied, and yet you still have to go day to day and live your life. much of my time was spent like that, not always on a 95%, 5% basis, but some days were like that. During this time, what I realized had happened, when this big explosion had happened in the dream, is that all the assumptions and everything that I believed about myself, about my religion, about life in general, the whole thing had blown up. The very fabric on which I rested my beliefs and my life had blown up. Every time I took a step forward, it was squished. There was no solid ground here. And what I spent the time doing in the next 11 years was trying to put this puzzle back together again. The edge pieces were gone. The edges were different. The pieces that previously fit together no longer fit together for me. So during this time, what I named years later was I made the enormous transition of moving from parts to whole. And as that happened, and the longer I got into this process, the more I realized that my thinking patterns had changed significantly. And it's very obvious to me in my day-to-day life now that my brain is no longer wired the way most of my coworkers or family is wired. In the early, mid-80s and on, I started to write educational grants. During this time, I got 11 grants funded. And people are always surprised at that, and they say, well, you must have found a formula. What happened? How come you're getting all these grants? And I said, it's very simple, but it's very complex. I'm writing the grant proposals from a holistic viewpoint. And the people who are funding the grants are buying it. It's not like anything else that's coming across their desk. And indeed, that was the feedback that I was getting from the grant boards. What have I learned in this time? An awful lot, but one of the most significant lessons I learned was that we do indeed have a very deep source of wisdom within us. We know what we need. We normally are so busy and so active or so fast asleep, we can't hear the inner voice. I think our psyches are fairly screaming at us to get our attention if we only knew how to read the languages. Very often it's not a verbal language. One of the questions people used to ask me was, did you see this as a call to priesthood? And at the time I said, oh no, I don't see this as a call to priesthood. What I didn't pay attention to was during the same time period, I was collecting wine goblets by the score. I had developed a love affair with whole, round loaves of bread that were unsliced. That's what I mean by telling our stories in a thousand small ways. That probably only occurred to me a year ago. I had been doing that for 15 years. It takes a long time to wake up sometimes. The story doesn't end with August 12th, obviously. I don't have time to talk a lot more, but this spring I had an amazing piece of writing cross my path. I did find a man who could hear my story. This was about a year and a half ago. And to be able to tell my story to a man and have the man say, I hear you, and this is what I think is happening. This was a theologian. Was very powerful for me. It was powerful because I don't feel like what happened to me is strictly a women's story. I think it's got value for everybody. There's a newsletter that's published in Minneapolis by Terry Dosh, and it's called Bread Rising. Terry Dosh is a laicized priest who is very active globally with the thousands and thousands of laicized priests in the world trying to get the Catholic Church to recognize the married priesthood. So he puts out a newsletter every 2 months, bimonthly, called Bread Rising. And Frank, the theologian that could hear the story that I had to tell, gave this to me in early spring. This is the April-May issue, 1996. The title of it is called Woman's Sorrows Over Her Call to Priesthood Aborted. This is a story that comes out of Ireland. And if it's happening here, and if it's happening in Ireland, where else is it happening? When I read this, I was in shock. It was like reading my own story all over again. And I'm just going to read little short parts of this. At the end of my first year at college, I had an experience which, though it happened over 20 years ago, will remain with me forever. Sound familiar? It changed the course of my life. It was a profound experience of God as love, not in the intellect, not in the mind. It was real. How to respond to such a tremendous love? I could not keep it to myself. It had to be shared. That's what I felt about my story. I walked in here last night. I've never been at a reimagining conference, and I burst into tears because I knew I had come home. I needed to tell my story. And then very quickly, the sense of being called to the priesthood came. It was very disturbing. I had not been brought up with the idea of women being priests, and I had never challenged it. I did not see my life in terms of the priesthood, and when the calling came, I think it brought me to the verge of, and it is not too strong a word, insanity. She attempted an overdose at the time, which she recognized as a deep cry for help to try to understand something which nobody could help me understand. She goes on to say, Jackie Hawkins, I'm not sure, this must be an Irish woman, has talked about priesthood as a baby who was perhaps miscarried or whom the institution would want to abort. This is a Catholic woman, remember. I did not think it is too strong to talk about calls to the priesthood being aborted in women. It is the life of God planted in women's hearts, which is being aborted. Then in 1990, it was just too much. The baby was alive and kicking and wanted to be born. It had not been aborted, but by the grace of God was still there. And in 1990, in great pain, but birth is never easy, that baby came forth. It was not the end of the pain. After that, it had to be spoken. It had to be shared with neighbors, friends, with bishops, people in power. There was more pain, and I suppose a real encounter with the cross. I have not been sexually abused, but I have been profoundly spiritually abused by my own church, the Catholic Church, whom I love deeply. We're not in this journey alone. Thank you for helping me break my loneliness.